Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about classic work in management and organizational studies. This is episode 61, where we are discussing Dan Brass' paper, Being in the Right Place, a Structural Analysis of Individual Influence in an Organization, originally published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1984. In this first part of the episode, we will discuss the main ideas of the text and its positions within management and organizational scholarship. In the next week, we will release the second part of the episode. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And this is Pedro Monteiro, coming from Lyon in France.
Hello, I'm Catherine Jackson, calling from Royal Leamington Spa.
This is Sarah Ottner from London, UK.
Today we are joined by Sarah Ottner, who is a Junior Research Fellow in the Strategy and Organizational Behavior Group at Imperial College Business School. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Sarah, since you suggested the text, could you start us off by giving a quick overview on what it is about and why you recommended it?
So, thank you, Pedro. This paper is one that I thought the podcast would enjoy discussing because for me, it has two key contributions to management scholarship and also, as we'll discuss later, to the shaping of Administrative Science Quarterly as a journal. And one is that it really marks the beginning of bringing network studies from mathematical sociology to a mainstream management audience and making people comfortable with using network forms, network methods, and really thinking about structures and the interplay between structures and individuals. But the second, which Brass makes a big deal out of in the introduction, is how this paper is using field methods and a real departure from lab studies, which had been the majority of individual level projects to this point. So for me and my research, both of those things have been really instrumental since before the doctoral days. And since it wasn't already done on the podcast, I thought it was really important for the audience to know what this paper means to scholars like me.
No, we are very delighted to have you and to have such a new addition to our canon. You know, one of the efforts that we try to do is always to cover the known classics, but also to try to expand both in terms of who is considered a classic and also try to trace down where specific conversations and discussions emerge from. So it's great to be able to look back where does discussions on network theory come from in organizational theory.
Well, one of the places that Brass starts from is actually not about networks at all. The discussion starts about power, which is not a surprise when you think of who was the editors that he was submitting to and who were the major organizational behavior theorists at the time. So he starts by taking the concept of power and the frameworks that contribute to how we understand who has power, how do they express it, what are the limitations on it. And what this paper does is to start by saying, I'm going to take a look at what he says are the enduring characteristics of an organization, so systematic relationships and structures, and actually how individual behaviors and individual patterns create, replicate, expand, change those otherwise taken for granted structures. So it actually sets itself up as a power paper, but what it is all about interpersonal relationships and, like we said, that birth of network studies in mainstream management.
Yeah. It's a challenge that all papers and books need to uphold is that we are, as academics, we end up being interested in specific methods and approaches. But the question is always, what does it allow us to see, how it advances the conversation? And I think powers, as you said, is a very fitting doorway or hook to showcase how mapping the relations and the positions and all the structural properties that exist that people are influence the extent that people can, you know, have influence and authority.
Yes, and another part of it is also, like you say, how does this paper help academics who are trying, not necessarily interested in power and network, is to show how that Brass walks that balance between using existing research from the people he's writing to as editors, as action editors, as other reviewers, and then says, but here's what my paper does that's different. Why is difference not scary? And what is the contribution of that difference? So in hindsight, we can see how it has really been a step change in research. But when it was written, it was supposed to be another contribution that fits in to the existing canon. And this is the kind of paper that all of us as scholars would like to produce.
Yes. Yeah. So it's something that, you know, the framing is very much incremental, but it turned out to be a watershed.
I think so. Yes, I think so. And that's why it belongs in this kind of podcast. Yeah.
Okay. So let's maybe go through what is exactly that Braz is doing in the paper. You know, we talked about the framing, but what is exactly, what, for example, for one, I think it's very telling that he is interested in the structural properties and talks about organizational structure. But even already there, there is a seed of expansion of this very category, because he's talking not just about, you know, the formal so-and-so, but also patterns of behavior, which already, I think, is a little shift in the discussion there.
Yeah, actually, the framework that he uses is to say that he's going to go through three different types of networks within an organization. So he starts by saying that he wants to look at the patterns of workflow. How did people do their jobs and move information and product through the organization? The second one is about communication. How do people pass information, but how do people share in each other's lives within an organization? And then the third one is what he calls friendship networks, or now what we call them as affiliation networks. So those are the three different structures that he starts by saying, here's what I want to look at. Where before, everything was looking from in a very economic angle about exchange of goods. Maybe we were looking at social capital, social exchange. But here we move beyond that and say, what else do people do at different levels and roles of the organization? And how can we make things that are similar and things that are different across those three? So that's what the premise of the paper is, to look at those three different types of networks in a real organization. So in this case, he's looking at a newspaper. And he goes out into the field to look in a real organization instead of looking at simulated groups in lab studies or in standing groups and teams, which goes all the way back to sociology of like gangs on the street corner in Chicago, which is its original field studies in sociology and management as well.
So one note, I think it's, you know, as in the focus on both the workflow networks, communication, friendship, it's again telling, because it's a shift. You know, this is 1984 and we already had the whole contingency scholars, which very much has put structure in the foreground. But here we already see the start of the discussion that goes beyond just that, but to take an account not necessarily the action, but the lived interactions in the workplace. And, you know, and that is captured here.
Yes, and their consequences. So
yes,
to go a little bit forward into the paper, one of the consequences that Braz measures is he goes back 3 years later to look at promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So although it was not part of the original setup to say, how do these behaviors affect promotion likelihood, at this time in this organization, promotion was a valuable outcome, an interesting, informative outcome. So he leaves a longitudinal gap, a three-year gap, to then assess who's still there, and then of the people who are still there that he previously studied, who got a promotion. So it also moves it onto the consequences.
Yes, that's true. And he talks about that, on how influence and power is a very much attributional dimension, but he has also this, which seems to be very revolutionary by the time, this new type of variable, of kind of data, that is not just coming from what people consider to be the influence peer, but also what is really happening in the organization. And it's always interesting, because I think, well, I'll be curious to know, but from our impression in the podcast, it seems that field work and field research has always had a very important role in organizational theory and management more generally, in letting us see new things, in really like showcasing and pushing the conversation, you know. So it's always good to have another example of the importance of going into the field. You know, we know how difficult and time-consuming it is, but it, you know, scientifically has a lot of promise.
Yeah, and I think we're at the beginning of another phase of field methods, and particularly field experimentation. So, for example, organization science has a special issue in 2020 on field experiments in organizations and management research. So there's been a sort of pendulum relationship between when is the lab dominant and when is the field dominant, when are single methods what most of the dominant scholars are doing versus when do we need mixed methods, or you must have multi-methods or mixed methods to get into a top journal. So in this paper in 84, for example, this is actually a mixed methods field study. There are multiple phases of interview. There are external sort of observer data collection and self-report data. And there's even a spot data collection and a longitudinal follow-up. So of the time, and that's probably one of the reasons why it was so successful at Administrative Science Quarterly, because that's something ASQ has always been very good at developing through the review process, these strong multi-method, multi-approach papers. So that's probably why it was so successful, because it weaves all of those pieces together where you think, oh, of course, this is the way it is done. Of course, this must be natural that all projects are done this way, when it's really quite a step change in the research.
Sorry, it's just really interesting listening to both of you talking about it kind of from a working academic perspective, I guess. I guess I'm coming at it from a practitioner perspective in a way, which is slightly different. Just interested in how kind of groundbreaking it is. And I just had a little look at a kind of quick and dirty analysis of Brass and the other papers he's written, which isn't strictly why we were reading this, and his trajectory, and just seeing how influential he is more widely in social network theory. So would we say that this was the beginning of that?
I think it's the beginning of taking what was previously discussed only through formal algebraic proof, let's say, or applied math perspectives that we borrowed from physics, that we borrowed from biology, came into sociology, mathematical sociology, and now it's being translated, applied, used in management research. I can't swear that it's the first time these concepts of centrality and criticality and non-substitutability have been used. But for me, this is the oldest paper in my set of endnotes, other than the original Freeman source, when I go back to the beginning of network contribution.
And has it had the credit that it deserves for that, do you think?
I don't know. I looked up the influence network of this network's paper. So it's only had about 2,000 citations in what is now 35 years. I don't know whether we think that's about right or whether we think it's underused. But when you look at the number of citations Mark Granovetter's papers have had, I would think it's underpowered for the influence that the paper has had on the way we approach these types of projects.
Sure. And hence why we're discussing it on the podcast, to hopefully shine a light on it, give it the credit that it deserves.
Back to the paper. We talked about the goal, the framing, the kind of, you know, analysis that's trying to be done, and where the methods used. So let's try to go deep a bit more into the findings, you know, what exactly that he discovers.
So there are a couple of different contributions that I think, but starting at the end, one of the most interesting things for other academics is that there are quite a few non-significant findings or hypotheses that didn't quite work out. Another one is when we discuss those three different types of networks, much of what he started to find looked so similar over and over that they just collapsed them into a single analysis. So it does give hope if you have, let's say, non-significant outputs or lackluster, what you think are lackluster findings, that they might still be contribution in publishing non-significant findings. So that's the first thing that's useful. There are a couple of other contributions for me, I think, with this paper. They're not direct outputs. But one is about the concept and the definition of what he calls a dominant coalition. So the paper defines dominant coalitions as a small group of individuals typically occurring in the highest positions who have the most influence or decision-making authority. So this would be something that would follow directly from power definitions for sure. What's important in the paper is that although he sets out that definition and that's what he expects to find, that doesn't map entirely to what the participants report. So that's very interesting when you're going through the information. And another is that the longest serving employees, which we would assume would be overlapping with, let's say, tacit knowledge, process expertise, different things that contribute to power and influence in an organization, actually are not reported as the most powerful people. So again, that's a nice, surprising finding.
Yeah, sorry, that was one of the exceptions, wasn't it?
Yes. And that's a lovely section as well, where we all say discussion, limitations, future research, and final conclusion. That's become formulaic. He actually calls out a section that's marked as exceptions, which is, here are the participants who just completely did not follow my plan. You know,
yeah.
I'm just going to report them here.
Yes. There is something about the paper, and I think it's probably a hallmark by the nature of the way social scientific papers were written, that it seems very true to the findings, to the empirical material, you know, very much as reporting. You know, we all discuss that, and it's a big debate within our field and beyond on how the way papers are written are more and more and more far away from the way, you know, discoveries really happen.
Yes. And also that you could take that to a sinister extreme and say, in social sciences or in any field, is this the entirety of the project that's being reported, or are there other pieces that are being left out? And this paper is really brave.
Yes.
In after many rounds of revision, the editors and the reviewers and the author together all managed to keep in these parts that didn't go according to plan, but nevertheless are still important for scholars to understand.
Sometimes I think that undervalue the power of more incremental, or exactly discovering what we expect, but it's not true. You know, it's this pure incremental, I would say, mentality of the discovery of science that is not just, you know, radical novelty all the time. But, well, that is a different tangent.
But it is something that also plays into the multi-method approach, was that they didn't just stop when the direct report information came back and didn't match the expectations. They did a further round of interviews to try and figure out why didn't it work? When might it work, but it didn't show up this way? So in other words, what are the boundary conditions? Which things are individual exceptions that deserve their own sections? And when did we need to actually rethink what we're looking for? So you asked me also about sort of the nitty-gritty findings, or the actual data that's for that we can say, what does this paper teach us? And recall that I said that we were starting with the three different types of networks, workflow, communication, and friendship, but actually Brass reports at the very beginning of the results that there was so much serial correlation and overlap that everything will be combined to only talk about the communication measures from then on. So even that admission, decision, choice, whichever language you like to use, that itself then shaped network studies in organization and management going forward, because then they looked at actual communications. So there are studies that look at email back and forth, email trail for people. And that's a narrowing or a focus on communication patterns to show us who we are and what we're really doing, instead of a rosy self-reflection. And you could say that was an artifact of choice to look at communication instead of workflow.
Yes. I'm really not an expert in quantitative methods. My brain's a bit rusty on all that. But as an organizational person, I am not surprised that this overlap exists, because, you know, the nature of the task and the work, of course, influences the interconnection that people have. And we know that. Yeah, so I'm not surprised that this exists, but it's interesting to see exactly this admission. And I wonder how other methods, and this is something we can maybe talk in the second part, would have been able to tease more these differences. We see the reporting of the people, but we do not see the work being done in itself, which provides a different angle. But I'll save this for later.
Yes, absolutely. Although, as in any good paper, there will always be suggestions for future research. And there are suggestions, yes, about how to expand this through different data collections or different organizations, exactly as you say. So another contribution of the paper, I think, is this discussion about the proposition that was made about uncertainty. So this is, uncertainty is important in status research because one of the functions of a status system and a hierarchy in organizations is to help us identify who to listen to in an emergency, right? And an organizational emergency is uncertainty. So we under conditions of uncertainty, all else being equal, we look to our experts and we defer to them in decision-making under uncertainty. The proposition that this paper looks to investigate is whether uncertainty influences who becomes most central in these networks. And one of the major findings, as he says, is that coping with uncertainty, centrality, and non-substitutability, which is a concept that he uses earlier to say, how replaceable are you to your colleague? Uncertainty, centrality, and non-substitutability were all necessary but not sufficient conditions for acquiring power.
This is very interesting, especially in the light of later research, which has shown, think about people that study software engineers and how attempts to own the code or not share information, people hoard information, you know. Well, I think what's interesting here is that there is almost like a lay theory that we all expect and that people tend to live by in organizations in terms of, you know, willingness or not willingness to share information, willingness or not willingness to mentor people, whatever it is, or make, in the case of software engineers, the code available to others, because there is the expectation that that's going to be a guarantee of power and, you know, influence. So in a way, it's interesting that it takes this lay theory and it showcases it partial truth, so to speak.
Well, yes, but what it's also doing is setting up these boundary conditions. In the paper, the network theory that does get discussed and introduced is about the individuals. It's the beginnings of the idea of brokerage. And we are going to talk in the second half about how this paper is situated in management theory. But there is a direct line that we can draw, and we will look to see between this paper and brokerage and Ron Burt's 2009 book on structural holes. And Ron Burt was on the editorial board of ASQ when this paper was accepted, so he would be fully aware of it at the same time. So what this paper does in the same section is to put boundary conditions on this understanding, which, and what it says is these positions at the extremes, so what we will now call these broker positions, these positions were on the external boundary, but they involved very little uncertainty, and individual workers were not highly critical, but they were still rated as therefore having very little influence. What we previously thought in our lay theory would make someone influential or valuable actually turns out not to contribute as much as we thought. So when you think of when you're in the doctoral programs, in reading through papers like That's Interesting about developing as a writer, that's a very quick but powerful way to turn, right? That's a turn that shows us something we didn't know before in such a way that we don't have to reject everything we ever learned, but we can start to turn our focus towards expansion, deeper understanding, boundary conditions, limitations. That's where future project generation really occurs.
Yes. And personally, I am particularly biased towards that because I think that's one of the main strengths of a field like ours, which has a more specialized attitude towards specific object, context, whatever we may call it, which are organizations. So it is exactly trying to understand in a more comparative, fine-tuned way when and how we may expect this or that.
And without making us obsess over every line of every paper, there's another example also in the discussion where Brass writes that powerful persons may not need to instigate communication. They may be sought out by many others. Thus, observing which party instigates the interaction may provide additional insight. So what he's actually doing here is contributing to the birth of directed networks. So it's no longer enough to just say who is between two other people, who's a mediator, or who is at the edge that helps connect, who is a broker. This is actually the beginning where we say, okay, now we need to really look at directed networks to understand, which at the time, with the computational power we had, pencil and paper, or maybe some time on the punch card computer, naturally limited what context you could study. But if you think now in 2019, 2020, with the removal of those barriers, what directed networks are possible and what is left to study in directed networks in the 35 years between that single line and network studies now?
Yes. As someone very interested in form organization, what I found fascinating about the paper, and I think I don't know the literature so well as you, so I would be curious to know what it meant back then, is the attention towards the multiple, we may say, levels of organizations in trying to look at both at within a unit or a work group, cross work groups at the organizational level, and trying to see all the different networks that are being mapped and how much access and control people have within them in these different levels of analysis, so to speak, you know, which I find interesting because, again, it very much showcases a very holistic structure of organizations.
Yeah, it's, for me, what this paper does is, and why I use it for myself in my own work, is it starts to build this level of meso-organizational behavior. So what Brass says right up in the introduction is that the focus of studies previously at the individual or interpersonal level were on behaviors or traits. So we know that we inherit that from the history or the parentage of psychology. And otherwise, when we looked at power, dependency, resources, structures, business units, it was at the level of the unit or the firm. And so that it, right here, he's trying to set up a case without even stating it in so many words, but a case for a meso-organizational behavior, which is very near and dear to my heart because I am also attempting to build a sub-discipline of meso-organizational behavior.
In a way, even though we work on different areas, not to, make it all about yourselves, but I see this connection, even though I'm from a very different perspective and method, which is exactly trying to understand this role of the organization, this nature of the structures, or how it is, you know, how organizations function and how does it really matter for how people work, for how people behave, or how, you know, the interactions that take place. Take this as a specific realm, so to speak, of analysis.
Well, one of the things that's important for me in terms of looking at structures, I'm not fully a structural sociologist, but I'm moving that way, is that structures are a set of decisions by people. And they do have a lot of inertia, but they can be changed. I think that's part of what this paper inspires us to do, is instead of to look at this structure as externally imposed or otherwise immutable, is to take it down a level and look at how it's constructed, reconstructed, expanded, changed by individuals. That's also what's really interesting to me with the almost accidental longitudinal study. By going back 3 years later to check on promotions or to check on consequences, in a way, Brass can also check whether the structures are even still there. You could almost start the project again and look for these structures again.
I'm curious about this meso-organizational behavior that you talked about. I was curious to understand more what you mean and how you think that this paper
relates
to that.
Well, for me, the case of meso-organizational behavior is exactly that, moving on from your parents, you know? If your parents are psychology and economics, we now have behavioral economics. If your parents are sociology and economics, we have very clearly economic sociology. So for myself, if I had to choose the subdiscipline, I would say economic sociology. But if your parents are psychology and sociology, then you exist in this liminal space, this tension in the middle of that you're not micro enough because you're not looking at affect or perception or neuroscience or cognition. So micro-OB these days, for example, can put CEOs inside an MRI scanner and look at fMRI patterns to see whether there are brain firing patterns common to those who get to extreme positions of leadership. So that is what we get from the very micro side. And then if you're not micro, what's left for you really is macro, which has been primarily the preserve of strategy and international business, where the smallest unit is usually the business unit or the department, let's say. But there have been many scholars who are otherwise in the middle with one foot in both camps. Usually we're in micro for teaching, and then we move around in economic sociology or org theory for our research.
So I think there is a natural affinity to what you propose and the kind of research in organizational theory that I'm particularly biased towards, because it's the one I do and most podcasters, I think, do, and also the classics that we cover, because I think classic OT is very much based on that, which is, as you're saying, individual or small groups in relation to the structure, taking the organization, you know, it's the whole discussion of the big O, taking the organization as consequential for the kind of research that we do. That is not just the background or setting, but the nature of organization is such that it influences the interactions, relations, patterns that we are interested in uncovering. In a way, I almost take it for granted because it's very much what I think is part and parcel, or at least at the origins of organizational theory, it was. It is understanding that organizations are particularly complex machines and the way they function is such that it creates particular challenges, problematics, and of course, behaviors and patterns. So let's think about the paper a bit historically. It is, what, 35 years since it was published? Just by the way we have been talking, it's very clear how relevant and how strong its findings are. It almost feels brand new. So let's try to think, what do we know about when it was produced? Do a bit of detective work and think of its history.
Absolutely. So Administrative Science Quarterly, ASQ, the journal, has been published continuously since 1956. So the journal itself was almost 30 years old by the time this paper came through the process. At the time that the paper came out, so the December 1984 issue, the entire journal editor was Carl Weick. And the action editor on the paper was Jerry Salenti, which, if the name doesn't mean anything to you, you can look through Brass's paper just how many times he takes on the work by Salantic and Pfeffer, which in power, at that time, in power and influence, were the canonical works, the textbooks and the canonical papers on power and influence in organizations. So that's the AE that he was up against in submitting.
Or working with.
Yes, or working with. Yes, exactly. At ASQ, it's very, very developmental process of getting the paper through. And just another tiny historical note for the fan nerds in the audience. Here are some of the household names that were on the board at the time of the paper. So Bartunek and Burt, Carroll and Cook, Crackhart, who becomes a co-author as well, Pettigrew, Pfeffer, Starbuck, Staw, Wetton, and Zucker. How many of those are on your own references list?
Yes, all the heavyweights.
And to show you the long legacy of this paper, I don't know if you know that ASQ keeps a list of awards for scholarly contributions, that papers 6 years after publication that have a long arc of influence. The 2018 Scholarly Contribution Award went to Adam Kleinbaum's 2012 paper on networks and showing us a real evolution in network theory in management. So it is still having influence from the 1984 publication to the 2012 paper to the 2018 Scholarly Contribution Award. So a really long arc.
Indeed. Well, all good scholarship, I think, tends to do that.
Yes. But what's interesting with this paper as well is there are other topics that it reaches that might or might not be using network methods that have taken from this paper more of the topic, which we have discussed less so far. So there are parts of positive organizational scholarship, creativity, ethics, social capital, and visibility and social status that all link back to this paper.
Before maybe we unpack that, and maybe we can do that in the second part, I think there is something very interesting and powerful on the idea of power that he's trying to put forward, right? And this more multi-layered kind of idea. Power is a multi-level concept, so to speak. He's supporting and pushing forward, at least how I read it.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you start that again, maybe?
I think there is something about the view of power that he's putting forward that is multidimensional.
Yes.
That seems to me a further nuance that has been introduced here or confirmed.
Yes. So it starts very much by saying power is a multi-level concept, but I think the perspective taken here is about multidirectional. If you think that power is control over resources, the approach that this paper takes is it talks about dependence or the inverse or independence. How independent individuals are makes them more powerful. So it's not necessarily about finances or information. Of course, those are involved, but it really discusses when might I need you, when might you need me, and how in those two don't necessarily cancel each other out.
Yes, exactly. And the interesting thing, of course, because it's trying to talk about not just about the work path, but also the communication. So how much information you have, and it has a lot of, you know, mediating variables. It is, think about it, contingency, scholarship, or even before, or the idea of structure as this very stable thing. And, you know, how one might think of power in relation to authority and positions within, you know, a typical line of command. But here, it's something that is more about the connections people have with each other, how much dependence or interdependency, which, you know, complexifies much more just the static organizational chart kind of view of power that might have existed earlier.
Yeah, exactly. In the text, it says, the complexity of the relationship between power and dependence increases when one considers the multitude or variety of resources that may be considered relevant in a complex organization. So there's two different types of complexity at the same time.
What interested me really is slightly diverting from what we're talking about is kind of influence and power and the difference between the two. I thought it was interesting as well that power isn't directly mentioned in the title.
Before you read this paper, what did you think the difference was between power and influence?
Interestingly, the paper confirmed what I actually thought from my own experience in work situations. So basically, people with influence can influence, and that gives them a certain level of power, but that ultimately it's the structure that determines the real power and the outcome in the end, which is effectively the conclusion from the paper, isn't it?
Yes, I think that probably we could say you can't overcome your structure, but I would put a little caveat to it and remind us to take a step back and say, well, who decided the structure in the first place? Powerful people at the time with concerted interests, right?
And also what comes across for me in the paper as well, that influencers are manipulators, but that ultimately, you know, the structure trumps at the end of the day.
So if you think that structure trumps, tell me how you would then look at the findings that talk about who gets promoted and who doesn't, or who's named as influential and who's not, outsized from their structural expectation.
So I'm not sure if it relates to that, but I think, you know, to go back to what Sarah was saying on this whole issue, who gets to decide the structure? What I think that is interesting in the paper, again, is that it showcases how some dimensions that might not be considered right away in organizational design, I mean, just uncertainty, who is at the core, at the technical core of the organization or not, the extent people have relations beyond the people they have interdependence with, you know, they're all kind of separate to just the box and arrows of organizational structure. So it's not just the structure in itself, but as the organization functions and as people populate these offices, and we can explore this more in the second part, influence gets distributed in ways that are more or less expected, but also are falling a bit beyond the traditional traditional dimensions of org design, you know, what are the positions and what are the relationships in a hierarchy. That is also something that adds another layer of understanding to that.
Yeah, and there is a point in quite early on where he says that organizational structure may result from informal or emergent patterns of behavior,
yes,
as well as more formally prescribed positions, you know, and he says, for example, workers may informally modify the prescribed workflow, engage in information exchanges that do not follow the formal communication channels.
Yeah, and there's even a section in the paper devoted to this unit of reference. So it says, the question of the appropriateness of the unit of reference is amplified when one considers the possibility of different structural locations being differentially important, contingent on characteristics of these positions. So in that sense, it's telling us again, like you said, this is not an organogram. This is not a prescriptive discussion. We need to take an appropriate comparator or an appropriate level of analysis, and if we were saying it that way, to look at the controls of flow, but also the uncontrolled flow.
Yes, exactly. Of course, we know that the literature later has paid much attention, and it's very much, you know, work of people that are interested in how work gets accomplished. It's very telling that Vike was the editor-in-chief back then, and he's citing him and talking about these informal dimensions. But all the work ethnographers, people like Steve Barley and many of his students like Beth Batchke, has shown exactly on the nature of accomplishing the work. It redefines and redraws the picture for how organizations function and those who get to have more influence and authority.
Oh, well, if we were discussing this, I would say, to me, discussing power and the basis of power, like French and Raven's structural and interpersonal basis of power, and saying that power is freedom from constraint or freedom from dependence, is very clear. And like you say, the lay theory, the lay understanding, I feel powerful when I have autonomy, right? This is why autonomy and work behavior is such a driving factor in job satisfaction. When you have control over how and when you achieve your objectives, you feel powerful, and perceived power is motivating. With influence, the way I would teach it in class would be the capacity to inspire or deliver change in others. And here the definition is to ask non-supervisors who is influential, who has pull, weight, or clout. But if I were explaining that in lay terms, to me that would sound like who gets multiple votes or whose vote is counted more heavily in decision making. And that's not the same. Yes, even that's a third way of thinking of it. But to me, the way it's defined here, it's less distinct from power than I think it was intended to be.
That's true. Maybe there's something that we can explore in the second part, because it's one of the things that I have here is that, if anything, there are always multiple forms of power, and he's not really unpacking that. You know, just to think of one can think about expert authority and functional authority. And that's a whole discussion on organizational theory about that, on how people in specific functional positions as leaders, you know, have clearly power mandated by the organization. But there are also people that are in positions that have a mandate to influence specific departments, but do not have the formal authority to do so, which is the typical people in a staff position. I think it's when, if anything, the limits what it can speak to, because the literature later has shown exactly that power is not... Organizations are much more complex than that, and sometimes there are different varieties of power that is expected from people, that emerges from people, that they might need or not to accomplish their specific tasks. So when you start to look at how the work gets done, and then you see forms of powers that emerge that are exactly closer to influence, so to think about the case of staff people, that are not within the traditional definition of an old. Power is just autonomy. And that concludes part 1 of episode 61. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, and our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And please join us next time as we continue our discussion of Dan Sprouse's work on power, social networks, and influence, here on Talking About Organizations.